at you. Can you, maybe for somebody who doesn't know you, tell us a little bit about yourself? Like, what do you do? Where do you come from? Maybe a little bit about your background as a developer and trainer and yeah.
Sure. So I'm originally from Ohio. I spent a lot of time in Cincinnati in my 20s, then moved away to Wyoming, where I taught the digital side of graphic design and 3D animation. This was back in 2006. 2008, I moved to Massachusetts and taught 3D animation and game design. And that's where I started to cut my teeth in game development. I was active in the IGDA group there called the Boston Postmortem, and met some friends, and we started making games. The first game that I was involved in was called Super Ramen Brothers. We made an iOS game in 24 hours and posted it the next day on the App Store. And things kind of went from there. After that, moved to actually prior to moving to Chicago, I did some freelance kind of art assets and 3D modeling and stuff for various companies in the Boston area. Did some contract work for Hasbro a little bit as a digital sculptor, then moved to Chicago. And basically the reason why I was moving the whole time is because I was involved in academics and teaching higher education courses at colleges. While I was in Chicago, I met a couple of clients and started making educational science games. At that point in time, I was working with Unity and C Sharp. Around 2014, I transitioned to Unreal Engine with the release of Unreal Engine 4. I'd messed around with the Unreal Development Kit and stuff like that, and had always been aware of Unreal Engine, always enjoyed the tool set. And so when they created Blueprint, I was able to quickly kind of catch on to it because of my C Sharp experience, and went from there and used that for my indie development and my contract work from then on. So up until most recently, I was working at a university here in Ohio, teaching game design, game development, and leading their game program. And then was recently contacted by Ryan Kingsley to come work at Vertex School. And I've been here for approximately a month and a half.
We'll get back a little bit to Vertex and the question of traditional and online education. I think it's interesting. But before we kind of jump that way, from your perspective as an instructor, as well as a person who has been developing games both in Unity and Unreal, what's going on with Unreal Engine 5 today that makes it such an important engine for the industry? Like, what are the things that they are kind of bringing to the table in your, from your perspective, that you feel like are, if not groundbreaking, but at least are, you know, super useful for developers all over the world?
Sure. Some of the things that I think are really fantastic about what Epic Games is doing with Unreal Engine is, one, the accessibility of it. And anyone can download it, right? Like, if you meet the minimum software requirements, you get access to the entire tool set pretty much for free, right? Like, you don't have to pay a royalty unless you've made $1 million or something like that, right? Which the accessibility, I think, is a huge thing. And the accessibility to the huge tool set, the entire tool set, is something that I would like to emphasize. Another thing is the way that, you know, the engine keeps progressing, and I feel like the rate of its progression keeps increasing. You have a very accessible scripting language with Blueprint, which I think is also very helpful. I think it's also very artist friendly. The tools, I think, are very accessible, which all the tools in the engine are very accessible, but there's a lot of complexity in there that you can quickly get to when you're kind of prototyping or iterating to make, you know, a really sophisticated product. I think another thing that's interesting about it is how it's beginning to serve multiple industries, film and video, right? Virtual production is fantastic. Not that they're the only one, but I think that they're doing a really great job with how they're handling it. The automotive industry as well. And the way that they support developers in all of these different verticals, I think is fantastic. With their own support, even with the Unreal Authorized Training Program, the support that they offer is really fantastic. So I think that their outreach to the larger community is something that, you know, can't really be overstated.
What about those elements? And thank you for your answer. I think all of those things that you mentioned, especially in terms of service, like they are providing the services and engine, right? Epic is doing a great job. They're also, and maybe this is why they're successful in kind of the movie industry and the TV and films. Maybe that's kind of like the secret sauce. But they're also investing a lot in the, you know, like the MetaHumans character builder. They bought Megascans a couple of years ago, and they're kind of implementing new tech into the engine. I guess trying to stay at the forefront of when, you know, what you think about when you think about, you know, high quality visual graphics, and you think about maybe NVIDIA, you know, companies like that, and Epic is definitely somewhere there. What do you feel about those additions, the ones I mentioned, like the Megascans and the MetaHuman? Do you feel like Nanite, and, you know, like if we can go on and on, do you feel they are as kind of groundbreaking for the industry, or are they somewhere, you know, like in the middle ground, or maybe somewhere in the beginning of their journey, and they're not really there yet to kind of change the way we think and build games?
Mm-hmm. I think that Quixel for sure is there, right? I mean, and another thing, it's about accessibility, right? So if you have someone that has this idea that they passionately feel that they need to communicate, having access to assets of that nature is really fantastic, I think. And you know, if you're working with Unreal Engine, you get access to the library for free, which I think is very generous, right? In terms of MetaHuman, I think that a lot of people can agree that, you know, a completely convincing digital human is no small task, right? I think that MetaHuman is getting there. I think that it's probably one of the most intense challenges in CG, right? To get a human that actually looks like a human, and then give people a tool set to kind of create their own. It's a big idea. And, you know, I think that it's an interesting problem to solve. It's been interesting to watch it grow and change, and watch, you know, I follow some of the artists that are involved in that process and kind of making convincing humans. I think that it's a really interesting kind of nut to crack, really.
Yeah. So we ask those questions, and in the answers, there was this theme of accessibility. Basically, you're saying Unreal, and probably it's fair to say that the other tools out are there following a similar path. I mean, you can see Unreal being very accessible, Unity being very accessible, Substance tools are also very accessible. You can get the Houdini indie license, which is, you know, costs basically nothing, and there is a lot of like smaller tools and so on. So when you have this And if we live in this age of accessibility in terms of tools and development programs and, you know, all that software, how does that influence education? Because, again, you can correct me if I'm wrong. A lot of people have this perception that education is a bit of like a little bit of a rigid structure. So you create some kind of course and then you run with it, even if it's maybe becomes obsolete here and there. How is that changing and with the current landscape? And what are like the factors that are influencing that change?
Well, from my academic experience, working in higher education, I guess you could say game education is a very competitive landscape. There are a lot of good schools out there. There are a lot of really great programs. The programs that I've worked in, I've always had to hustle with kind of staying up to date with what I'm teaching. I would change my curriculum yearly to make sure that it's up to date. Could almost change it twice a year now with the rate that everything changes. So, you know, I think that for people that are looking to go into this as a career, I think that that would be something to keep an eye on, is the rate at which curriculum is iterated. Because, nowadays it's definitely an iterative process. And I think that, you know, about software accessibility, it's a big deal. One thing you have to keep in mind is the financial landscape of students isn't equal, right? So there may be some who can afford a piece of software, no problem. There may be some who cannot. So when I get brand new students in my classes and they're learning tools and things, they'll all come in with completely different software stacks under their belt, right? Or no software stack. So that's something that you always have to keep in mind when you're running a course in this stuff, is you have to be adaptable. And a really great way to kind of make the adaptation to a street is being willing to give a little to get a little, right? So if a student comes in with some knowledge of Blender, you know, if I have knowledge of Blender, let's say, then I am able to communicate Blender concepts to them and, for instance, Maya, which is helpful because since I'm somewhat bilingual, I'm able to move between, or rather help kind of demystify the software that they're just now getting into, if that makes sense.
So, again, you said that people have different access to different software, and maybe because of their financial capacity, right? Or maybe because of some other factors. And you mentioned Blender. This is a software that there seems to be like a revival of interest to this, because like even on 80 level, we see like so many people react positively whenever we publish a story on something done in Blender. And the question I want to ask connected with that is, what do people, when they go to your course at Vertex or maybe before in your career, what do people actually want to learn when they're kind of entering this career? Apart from like a very general concept of let's build a game, what are the skills that they want to acquire, and how does that compare with the skills that the market wants?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll get folks that want to learn a variety of software, right? From where I worked previously. Currently, we have students that really want to learn Maya and the Substance Tools and Unreal Engine, right? And I think that landscape changes kind of almost based on region almost or location, which is kind of interesting to see. It's like a colloquial sort of mix of what people are into. I think that you know, when people want to make games, it's like they kind of start to blaze their own trail. But lately, a lot of the focus has been on Unreal Engine, for sure.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Ever thought modern video games should be more interesting? At The Gaming Blender, we take randomized genres, mechanics, and make a new game every episode.
I've added permadeath.
We have a survival game of a hardcore simulation, which could be House Flipper, and with the permadeath of XCOM. Then that all has to be an action adventure.
Yes.
Ooh, dear.
Yes.
And sometimes it doesn't quite work.
And you have a construction off over the course of the narrative.
A construction off? The way we can do this is that we ditch your idea entirely.
Entirely.
Check out The Gaming Blender on all your favorite podcast platforms now.
So in terms of teaching, let's say you're teaching Unreal Engine, how is this process different when you're approaching it in school, like in a traditional academia, right? And when you're approaching it in an online environment like Vertex. I know you mentioned that you worked in Vertex for not that long, but you probably do have an understanding how these things are different. And it would be interesting to hear from your perspective as an instructor, and how do you balance, what are like the trade-offs, and how do you balance between them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, you know, I think that this is a you know, going from online to physical courses and the comparison between the two, you know, being in a classroom is nice, right? Then the pandemic happened, right? And that really changed the landscape. So courses that I had previously taught in a classroom, I was teaching all online. And the students were able to quickly adapt because, I mean, we're mainly using technology, right? And they were able to use meeting tools like Google Hangout, Zoom, et cetera, and Discord. We use Discord heavily for collaboration. And it went pretty well. At first, there was a bit of a learning curve and kind of getting everybody to communicate and stuff like that. So that once things had eased in terms of the pandemic and we went back to school, you know, there are some folks that really preferred working online. And I think I did too, because there was less time spent for me, like moving files around and things like that. You know, there's something nice about being in a room full of people for sure. But I think that, you know, in terms of efficiency and being able to get things done, I don't think that there was, and being able to teach people, right? I think that, you know, doing that online was something that was completely doable.
So whether online or offline, there are still some skills that people are getting, right? And do you feel like what they're getting in terms of like their knowledge of Unreal or Substance, is this really something that the market desires currently? Or maybe there are some, you know, empty spots that not a lot of students know about, and there's like high demand for this kind of a specialty or this kind of skill set. Like I can name, let's say VFX, tech VFX guys, or like a technical animator, or, you know, like a rendering engineer. So maybe this is kind of like a more high level math thing. But I mean, you can't find those people very easily. And it's really challenging, because I'm currently working with some Houdini guys, and man, those guys are busy. Like even if you're a student, you can get like a decent salary and start working. And if you're like a senior or even like mid to senior, that switch, that's a very attractive salary somewhere like on the West Coast. And like from your experiences, are there some kind of bits in the pipeline where, you know, you feel like people might, you know, benefit more from?
I do. I think that, you know, a lot of folks, when they first get into their experience with game education, they want to become an indie developer or something of that nature, which, you know, is noble. And but there's something to consider is how saturated the market is, right? Something that I would suggest to folks that are interested in a career in games would be looking into technical art and what a technical artist is. And this is something that typically varies from studio to studio, depending on where you are. But in Unreal Engine, technical art has a bit more of a concrete definition. So you spend a lot of time, you know, making complex materials or building editor tools. Sometimes you're working with visual effects in that capacity, or, you know, working on props and environment art. So there are a lot of, different, I should say, tasks involved with working with, you know, becoming a technical artist. You're kind of like an artist programmer hybrid, and that's something that I would encourage folks to get into.
Yeah, tech art is definitely, like, we have a recruiting service on 80 Level called 80 Level Talent, and whenever we see anyone kind of registering in tech art, they immediately get offers. It's like people are looking for those kind of specialists all the time, and it's like big studios like Ubisoft and Nintendo, you know, all of the like AAA stuff. I have to ask. So you mentioned that like a technical artist is sort of like a blend between an artist and a programmer. But before that, you told one of the benefits of kind of using Unreal is the blueprints system, which kind of help visually build whatever the script that you're building and so on. Do you feel like Unreal helps to get into this specialty profession easier? Because I know whenever people go to some other software, they're like, oh my God, this is so complex. I will never be able to do it. And they spend way too much time kind of trying to get, you know, filling an understanding of what it is. But I know that when you're with Unreal, and if you want to do like a very simple VFX or anything, you can go into their like VFX editor and cook something pretty quickly. And it's usually a sign that people would be more interested in doing things when they get result kind of quicker. What's your take on that? Is Unreal a good environment to start exploring the technical art realm, or maybe there are some other software that you feel are also equally as beneficial?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that getting into technical art with Unreal Engine is a bit easier, I would say, because the interfaces between modules, right, are very similar. So once you're in, you can kind of pick up the language of Unreal, the visual language of Unreal very quickly. I think that's something that's really nice about Blueprints too, is, you know, it's a visual experience. So I mean, it's like if you're coming to this, you know, from more of an artistic angle, I think that makes it easier to understand. Of course, you can edit the interface with utility widgets and things like that. I think that it's also, you know, you can edit the tools in Unity as well with C#, right? So I mean, it's a similar philosophy, I think. And another one too is, you know, Blender and Python, right? Or Maya and Python. PyMel, those are all great ways to kind of start, I guess, honing your tech art toolkit, let's say.
When we're talking to, you know, students, when we go to talk with schools and so on, we have one of the slides basically says, become more technical. You know, when you go to like a room full of guys and girls, and they're like trying to get into the industry, and they're trying to, you know, make a name for themselves and so on. It seems like just getting this, like a bit of that skill set and knowing how to set up a nice shader in Unreal or something is giving you kind of a little bit of an advantage when you're doing this. And when you know stuff like, you know, procedural generation in Houdini, that's kind of like getting you way up there. And the question is, do you feel like we are maybe in a state where kind of technical is more important than artistic? Or maybe I'm kind of like, maybe it's a wrong impression and that art is still as important.
Yeah, I think that when you're doing this kind of work, there's typically an end goal, right? And the end goal, which, I mean, be it a film, an automobile interface, or a game, it's a interactive, creative, aesthetic experience. So, I mean, from that angle, I mean, I think that creativity is and artistry is still very much involved. I just think that the tools that are being used to be creative are changing, right? And it's important to keep up with that. And I mean, you can have, like when you're prototyping an idea for a game or a mechanic or something like that, it can be a lot like sketching in a way, right? You may find surprises. Like it can be an emergent process. And in the emergence or serendipity of that process, I think creativity can live there for sure.
You mentioned a couple of things there, talking about a kind of new technology constantly disrupting, constantly changing, and the importance of like trying to keep up. I'm not even saying keeping up. It's just like trying to keep up with whatever's happening. Because I like my favorite story, and I repeat it, I think, too many times on this podcast, is when I talked with the guys who were doing Crysis, like from Crytek back in the day. And I met them, like, I feel like it was 2017 or something like that at Gamescom. And they were like, we were talking about back in the time there was like Quixel, DDO, like NDO tools, and there was Substance. And they were like, wow, man, these things are revolutionary. Because before that, I remember I was walking down the hall in Crytek, and Crytek is a big studio, and there were like dozens of people just sitting in ZBrush, and they were sculpting rocks, or they're sculpting bricks to make textures, right? And that was like a huge leap. And today we have, you know, we have procedural tools, we have photogrammetry, and we also have kind of slow adoption, which is going in through some friction, obviously, a lot of AI tools. And we have stuff like Midjourney and, you know, the chat programs. And we see a lot of papers where people are basically generating 3D out of nothing. Like they're using like a 2D image and it can generate a 3D model. And definitely those systems are learning very quickly. And we're going to see more and more of those tools. It's just, you know, inevitable. And Adobe is doing a lot of work in that direction as well. And NVIDIA, and you've seen what their experiments look like. And my question is, like, in this environment where it seems like these tools basically can do anything, what do you feel people should concentrate on? Do you feel like they should still kind of, you know, grit and, you know, try to work with, you know, the Unreal tools, or should they kind of jump the wagon and try to play around with the, you know, Midjourney or maybe some other tools? Like, where do you think this whole technological progress is going to take us? And I'm asking you, Matthew, because probably during your career in education, and you mentioned, like, remember I asked you in the beginning where you sometimes need to change your course even twice a year. So what do you feel is going to happen? Do you feel like there's going to be more changes coming? How are those tools going to influence? Do you feel like AI is going to take maybe part of like a boring work? But so far it seems like it's taken only like a fun work from kids. leaving the UVs and all the other stuff to you. So what do you feel about it?
Yeah, I would, you know, I think that's a really good point. I think that, you know, the machine learning folks need to work on maybe some better, quicker UV generation with AI. How about that? That would help a lot of people out. But I think that, you know, there's a lot of opinions about, you know, AI art and what AI is going to do to art and things like this. And, you know, it's a compelling debate. There's a lot of, you know, kind of one, you know, when you offer up an opinion, it seems like, you know, people want to look into, you know, the individual offering the opinion and these kinds of things. I've seen it on my social media feeds. And, you know, I think that a lot of the opinion and debate for me is rooted a lot in confusion and also probably some fear. There's also, I think, a lot of debate around the authenticity of AI art, which I don't know if I'm necessarily sold on that concept. So, you know, I've just kind of been hanging back and watching it all unfold for myself. What comes to mind for me with this debate is, you know, if you look back at the canon of art history and you look at the invention of a camera and people were taking photographs, and then, you know, the photorealistic painter really took a hit in his yearly revenue, right? Because now we could just take pictures. So, I mean, is it a technological revolution similar to that? I mean, it's possible. Another thing to think about too is, you know, I believe that when you're offering up text prompts to something like Midjourney, I think that you're teaching the algorithm, right? So that it's learning. So, I mean, it's almost like we're contributing to this creative hive mind in a way when you're working with AI art. Is it possible that it's gonna make like the job of the concept artist irrelevant? I'm not necessarily sold on that notion, because sometimes you have to have like a carefully crafted idea from a brief or something like that. So like dropping something into Midjourney might not cut it. I mean, maybe in 20 years it might. I don't know. I mean, it depends on how much the algorithm can learn. Another thing too is, you know, I think that with AI art, you know, you enter a prompt and it becomes this, it almost becomes like a haiku or poetry, right? So I've heard people call it more of like a literary tool than a visual tool. Something else to consider is like when you drop in those prompts and you get that result, I mean, I think that people get a dopamine hit out of that. So I think it's really similar to somebody liking your stuff on Facebook, which is a consideration as well, I think. So it's a really complex topic. I mean, I've messed around with Midjourney. I enjoyed messing around with Midjourney. I think that it's, you know, I would take the images and then bring them into Photoshop and tweak them or paint over them or mess with it. You know, and I mean, you would do the same thing with reference photos. So it's like if someone's taking photographs from a magazine and building a collage, right? I mean, they're recontextualizing the meaning of that image. So, you know, who has the ownership? You know, okay, fine. I mean, authorship can be a topic for sure. But I mean, I think that maybe what we need to figure out with AI art is what is the most important topic first, because right now everybody's just kind of like shooting from the hip with their opinion on it, which I don't know if that's necessarily like the right direction. I don't think the shotgun approach is the correct way to look at it right now. That was really long-winded.
No. You touched on a lot of interesting points there. Like, I like the First of all, yeah, we can all agree that there are some ethical questions and like copyright questions that are not clear. And definitely when you have like a Blender plugin and there are like first and last name of the artist and they replicate the same style, you begin to wonder like how does that work? Like, are they getting compensated or like why are you using their names? It just seems weird. But the other thing you mentioned is like when, you know, you go to a studio and usually it works this way. Like they give you a bunch of references and they say, I want this thing to look like that thing and a bit of that thing. And it's just like a mix up. And a lot of very early concepts are basically kid bashing. Like you do a collage, you do a bunch of pictures from here, pictures from there, and then if you're skillful with Photoshop, you basically blend it all in and it looks nice, and you can start working with that and show it to your art director and go from there. And it seems like this is the same process. It's just a little bit of a different tool. And I feel like when people started doing this with Photoshop, we had the same fear. People were also kind of scared that this might, you know, destroy their careers and so on. And probably some people did suffer. And I feel like we're in a very similar situation, and me professionally as well, because we're kind of running a publication and we write text, and there are tools out there right now that can write perfect text without any humans then doing okay job. And that begs, you know, you kind of have to do the question when, you know, are you really contributing something? Is this something that's, you know, valuable? And if it's not valuable, then eventually you're going to be, you know, substituted by an AI or some kind of other tool. And, you know, you mentioned like in 20 years, I feel it's going to be faster because it's they learn so quickly, those algorithms right now. Anyway,
I mean, it's kind of interesting. I think everybody's, it's like a point in time where everybody's wondering if we're moving more toward a Gene Roddenberry society or a dystopia, you know?
Yeah.
Which, I mean, it's interesting times, I would say. I think that it's really a fascinating topic. And yeah, I mean, it could make some things obsolete, but I mean, a good way to adapt, what is that? I mean, that's kind of what I think what we do as a species.
Yeah. Yeah, and especially in video game industry, it seems like this is the industry where people are constantly adapting to some new tech because visual fidelity is so important. And people are just kind of trying to iterate, add new stuff all the time, tinker with new tools. So I guess we'll just have to wait and see and try to adapt, as you said. We have like a little bit of like a flashball. So it's like very short questions, very short answers, and you can just answer from the top of your head. You don't have to go, you know, like super detailed. So first question, what's your favorite game of all time?
For me, it would have to be the Borderlands series.
Borderlands? Like in the Borderlands, which one? First, second, third?
Three was really fantastic. The way that they handled the art direction in three, I thought was really gorgeous. I felt that the story was really great. The interactivity was really fantastic. The weapons felt really good in that game. So yeah, I played it through probably three times, I think. It was really great.
Wow. Yeah, I remember first time I got the first Borderlands, which was back in the Xbox 360 days, it seems. I had a feeling that this was like Diablo. That was the kind of game that I spent probably, you know, like 2 days nonstop till I am at the end. Because there's like this mechanic with loot and everything. It's so addictive. You just get in there and it's just like, and it also had co-op. So I played with a buddy. So it was
exactly. They even had like the ambient music had a similar tone to Diablo also. if I remember. Yeah,
I feel like they were inspired by that in terms of like mechanically, definitely. So that was kind of like the big game of all time. What about the like the most underrated game that you can recommend to the audience? That's something that not a lot of people know about.
Oh, wow. I would have to say this is a very probably under the radar game, but a former colleague of mine made a game called Bruckel, and it's based on the story of his grandmother and the house while World War II was going on. And the story is fantastic, and you know, it handles kind of things from a more serious point of view, which is interesting, and it captures a real moment in history. But it does add kind of like some fantastical elements to it as well.
What about some maybe series or project or something that you felt like you couldn't get into, like something that you really didn't get in terms of games?
Project like how?
I mean, like you mentioned Borderlands you really like. What is something that you don't really like? Like maybe Souls games. You know, it's good, potentially, but you don't really, you know, you're not really into it that much.
Some of the later Star Wars games. Yeah, sometimes I have a hard time getting into those. And, I'm sure they're great games. I think it's just a matter of my age and my personal taste, I guess. So,
yeah. Yeah, I feel you on that. I feel you. All right. I think we have enough for like a little bit of a flashbulb. So, Matthew, it was a great pleasure talking to you today. I really appreciate that you found some time to talk to us. We'll add the links to Vertex and school so people can check it out, apply and explore all the different courses you guys have there. And maybe if there's like one thing that you want our listeners to kind of leave from this podcast, maybe some kind of advice or some tip that you want to give to younger artists or anything, what would that be?
It would be to learn to code and get involved with programming workshops ASAP.
Awesome. That seems like a very solid advice that we also give us a lot. Right, Matthew. Thank you so much, and have a wonderful rest of your day. Thank you.
Thank you, Krill. It was fantastic to talk to you.
Thanks for enjoying another episode of the 80 Level Roundtable podcast. Check out upcoming episodes on the 80 Level website at 80.lv. Join our career site at 80.lv/RFP. And share our podcast with friends and on your social networks.